now we've come to the middle wave system, Madhyamaka system, and Madhyamaka names itself the middle way. In a rhetorical move, you could say analogous to the Mahayana naming itself the Mahayana, since there aren't any Buddhists who don't say that their view is the middle way, as far as I know. That's all the systems organize themselves when they express a philosophical view clearly around the idea of differentiating what the extremes of reification or eternalism or permanence are on the one hand and what the extreme of nihilism is on the other. And then they all, from their own point of view, clearly refute these and establish themselves as having the middle way view. But they call it different things, but they, you know, the idea of the middle way is throughout Buddhism, so they all understand that they have to avoid both extremes. It's just that what they think the extremes are and then where the middle is quite different. And anyway, the Madhyamaka view came to be the dominant one in Tibet, and certainly one of the very important views in India. Of course, from where all Tibetan Buddhist teachings come, and then also in India and China. I mean, in China and Japan, it was present, although and not to say without influence, but not. You know, so people were aware of the view, and they had Madhyamaka texts, and people studied them. In fact, they had in China a really important Madhyamaka text that doesn't exist elsewhere, and so then people say, well, you know, could that really be a real Nagarjuna work, since it's, you know, we only have the Chinese. But anyway, so very important school that holds the view that I guess I would say that I'm subscribed to and find myself in sympathy with. It was begun in the sense of making this view clear in the world by Nagarjuna, who we understand as having lived sometime in the second century, although it's like all very unclear exactly, as I said, when different people lived in India. But I mean, nowadays, I guess Western scholars usually say circa 150 AD, which means we don't really know exactly when, but sometime, you know, in the second century, not precluding that he could have been born in the first century, but, you know, anyway, so, and then he also had at that time his disciple during his lifetime, Aryadeva, and who also wrote many texts. And a great many texts are attributed to Nagarjuna, and then everyone argues, like, not just between Tibetans and Western scholars, but then among Western scholars, everyone argues about which one of these texts was by the Nagarjuna, by which they mean the Nagarjuna who wrote the treatise on the middle way. So by Nagarjuna, then everybody agrees that we are referring to the person who wrote the treatise on the middle way. But then there's so many other texts, and there's a lot of these texts that most people agree probably were also by the same person who wrote the treatise on the middle way. And then, but then, like, not everybody agrees that all of those texts, and some of them end up that they're like tantric texts by Nagarjuna, and texts that express points of view which seem quite different, and sometimes, even if they're not tantric, from the point of view that is expressed in the treatise on the middle way and some of the other sort of core texts. And so then questions arise about, you know, well, how many hundreds of years did Nagarjuna live? And, you know, did he have, you know, all of these different aspects of his personality or all these different voices? But then, you know, it's not really clear. Everybody draws a line at different places. And then Aryadeva also wrote some texts which we have, which seem to have the same view in it that Nagarjuna's core texts have. And then the other important, you know, Indian Madhyamaka masters that Tsongkhapa talks about, refers to, and cites over and over again, from the 6th century, right, the 500s, there's Buddhapalita and Bhava Viveka, with Buddhapalita at least publishing before Bhava Viveka, but but you know, they probably were contemporaries. And then in the generation after that, and it's going probably into the 7th century. On some dates I've heard have him living his whole life in the 7th century, is Chandrakirti, who was, you know, we know as the person who interpreted Nagarjuna way to establish the Prasangika version of Madhyamaka. And then there's a number of other significant Svatantrikas, that people who in some way their view is different from Chandrakirti's, was more in some way like Bhava Viveka's, but are all within the Madhyamaka tradition, including Shantarakshita and Kamalashila and Gyanagarbha. And then there's also Shantideva. Shantideva lived in the 8th century, and these other people lived more or less also in the 8th century. So yeah, I didn't mean to say that Shantideva had a Svatantrika view. I was like putting the other Shantarakshita, Kamalashila, and Gyanagarbha in that category, and then Shantideva in the category with Chandrakirti. So initially, when few books were translated into Tibetan that presented the Madhyamaka view, they did not include the work of Chandrakirti, and so people's understanding of what the Madhyamaka view was based on Svatantrika texts, which weren't called Svatantrika texts, but were just Madhyamaka texts. And then in the 11th century, at the time that Tibetan Buddhism was being reestablished after having, you know, gone through a period of repression, and Atisha came to Tibet and told people, at least it seems, according to the verse that we found from the Satyavaya Avatara by Atisha, he told people that if they wanted to understand Madhyamaka correctly, they should follow Chandrakirti. And in that same century, I don't know exactly when, then the works of Chandrakirti were translated into Tibetan, and people noticed that they didn't seem to say the same thing as the other Madhyamaka texts that they had been reading before. And it was quite, it made a sensation, I would say, in Tibet, and initially, you know, among them, among the philosophically inclined, not all through the hills and dales, and not Beatlemania, but so at that time, it seems, the words Prasangika and Svatantrika came into common usage to refer to these two different types of Madhyamaka. It's you know, it may be that there's some trace, you know, roots for these in India, but as like a common way to clearly differentiate Chandrakirti and people who have his view of Madhyamaka from the other camp, that then this started in the 11th century. And the terms refer specifically to their logical method, right? That Bhava Viveka and his followers in interpreting Nagarjuna were insistent that one should use syllogisms in arguing with, you know, as a Madhyamaka. Your Madhyamakas are agreed in saying there's no such thing as ultimate or true existence of anything, anywhere, anytime. And so the question was, when you argue as a Madhyamaka against someone who thinks there are ultimately existing things, how should you set that up? And Buddhapalita, initially, having been, you know, this after Aryadeva, the first person, right, to really go through and say what Nagarjuna meant in the treatise, verse by verse, you know, sort of broke it down and explained it. And the way he explained it, these were all sort of reductio ad absurdum arguments. Well, almost all. Generally speaking, he formulated things as, like, you know, so somebody were refuting the idea of ultimately existent production, that things are ultimately produced. And so someone could hold the view that things are ultimately produced from themselves, that things arise from themselves, right? Actually, some people did hold that view. In Sankhya, they held that view. And So when you're arguing with the Sankhya, you know, and you're a Madhyamaka and they think that things are ultimately produced from themselves, how should you argue? And Buddhapalita said, well, we should say something like, you know, it absurdly follows that things will be produced forever, over and over again, because you say that they're arising from themselves. Well, that seemed like a good argument. But Bhava Viveka came along and said, there's a huge problem with that. You're just like tearing apart what their position is, and you're not saying what our position is. You're not positing that things lack ultimate existence. You're not stating what our thesis is. And not only that, you really can't take your syllogism, you know, things will be produced over and over again forever, because they're because according to you, they're produced from themselves. You can't, not only is that like not, doesn't tell you what our position is as Madhyamakas, but there's no way you can flip it around or invert it or negate part of it and turn it inside out so that it does seem to assert our position. So it doesn't like say what our position is as Madhyamakas, and it doesn't in any obvious way make it clear, just you're just saying what's wrong with the other person's position. You aren't like even leading them towards and saying that, you know, what the right position ought to be. And so that was part of his argument. Also, Bhava Viveka said that this way of doing things is logically incorrect, because when you're arguing with somebody, you can use these syllogisms, but they have to cash out or convert to a kind of positive argument where the subject that you're both arguing about is something that exists and which and when Buddhapalita is doing it, he either doesn't always have a subject, or he has like a non-existent subject, like a truly existent sprout or something like that, you know. And instead of just like, well, right, and he'll draw some absurd conclusion about this truly existent sprout. So this was problematic to Bhava Viveka, because just in the generation before that, Dharmakirti and Dignaga, right before that, had lived in India. And as we were talking about earlier, they're the ones who laid out Buddhist logic and Buddhist epistemology. And logic was extremely important in Indian academic circles, in India just generally, Buddhist or non-Buddhist. And now Buddhists have their own very clear, well-formulated logical system. And even though this had taken place, apparently, before Buddhapalita wrote, Buddhapalita didn't incorporate it, or at least from Bhava Viveka's point of view, he seemed to be doing a bad job. In other words, he wasn't putting on display what Buddhist logic could do by using the techniques from Dignaga and Dharmakirti to establish by valid reasoning the position of the Madhyamaka is that there was no ultimate existence. So then, you know, Chandrakirti came along and said, well, no, you know, Bhava Viveka is 100 years later, roughly. Chandrakirti came along and said, Bhava Viveka is wrong to attack Buddhapalita in this way, and it's perfectly appropriate for Buddhapalita, for the Madhyamaka, to use these prasanga, these reductio ad absurdum arguments, where you're just saying, you know, your position has these consequences. It's perfectly appropriate for us to use those arguments to refute the person who says that things are truly existent. So they have this disagreement. First, you know, Buddhapalita says, Nagarjuna says, just throw these contradictory consequences at the other person. And Bhava Viveka says, you can't do that. You have to have something that you're talking about and saying that people agree on, and then you have to say that thing doesn't ultimately or truly exist. And then Chandrakirti says, well, why not? What's wrong with the way Buddhapalita is doing it? Okay, so then those texts come to Tibet, and people say, well, they really disagreed about how to set up logical arguments, so we'll call the one that said you had to have this self-standing syllogism, where you say, you know, a sprout does not ultimately exist because it's a dependent arising, and you know that tells you what the view is. We'll so call those the svatantrikas, or the, you know, the autonomous, because they're saying you have to have a syllogism that stands on its own as putting forward the view. And the other people will call, the prasangikas, which means the consequentialists. And by consequentialists means like the people who throw reductio ad absurdum arguments at their opponents. That's what it means. Right? So the names of the schools are strictly on the basis of their logical method. And actually, that's mostly what people thought about and talked about at first. And that's, they thought, well, these are two differences in logical method. But Chandrakirti's, there were different people then after that, some who really still preferred the Svatantrika way, especially some who really liked logic, like there's this guy Chabachurgi Senge, who in Tibet, in Gelugpa, everybody debates on the monastic courtyard, and they debate, right, in a certain format. And that format wasn't thought up by Gelugpa, it was thought up by Chabachurgi Senge, this like Tibetan logician. And he was basically a Svatantrika himself, and his way of being a Svatantrika, of course, was derived from the tradition of Bhavaveka, who in turn got it from Dignagan and Dharmakirti. So that whole, process of the, exactly the way people debate on the debating courtyards now goes back through a Svatantrika lineage to these essentially, say, Sautrantika kinds of logicians before that, epistemologists. Right. So, but other people really liked what Chandrakirti was saying in Tibet, and as we talked about a little bit before, their way of understanding what Chandrakirti was saying was that, everything's just imputed by delusion or ignorance. When you talk about the conventional, what you're saying is that these things are posited by ignorance, and that overcoming or eliminating that ignorance, we realize the fundamental nature, which is emptiness or suchness. And when you have this realization of this fundamental nature, this clears away all dualistic elaborations or superimpositions by delusion. And that sort of seems to take conventionalities out of their false appearance, which means like you establish them as not existing. Right? Many people seem to, or others said, well, what Chandrakirti is really saying is that you can't, as a Madhyamaka, have any position at all. There is all that strain at all. Because if you hold that things exist, then that's reifying the extreme of existence. Or if you hold that things don't exist, that's holding the extreme of annihilation. So we, as followers of Chandrakirti, have to attain to a kind of systemlessness, if you say, like to be skeptics in the sense of not being attached to any dogmatic view, means not having any view that you can state, not having any position, not having any thesis. So then how do you teach? Well, you teach by way of skill and means, conventionally, compassionately, helping people what? Helping people what? Become free from their attachment to views, such a flight as you had, right? So then some people had that kind of interpretation of Chandrakirti. Okay, so then Tsongkhapa comes along, and he looks at this and makes something of the situation. In terms of articulating his view of what Chandrakirti meant, we already talked about that a little bit. Well, we did, in terms of that whole thing about the tree in the forest was basically about that, right? But he had a new way of reading what the Svatantrika and the Prasangika division was about. It's very based on this kind of very deep, penetrating reading. And he essentially said that these are two different philosophical schools. It's not the philosophical school. People who follow the Svatantrikas and the people who follow the Prasangikas are two different philosophical sub-schools. They're not advocating the same view and just using different logical methods. They have two completely different, not completely different, because they both agree that there's no ultimate existence. They both agree that there's no true existence. But they're different in other ways. And just to say what he thinks it is, Tsongkhapa argues that Bhavaveka and his followers in Svatantrika think that things do inherently exist conventionally, that things have intrinsic nature conventionally, but nothing exists ultimately. Okay, so ultimate existence is out, true existence is out, but things do have some nature of their own, let's say, as long as you don't look into it too deeply with the mind of ultimate analysis. Okay, you say now how did you don't find the place? I mean, everyone agrees this, right? That you don't find the place in Bhagavad Gita where he says, "I support inherent existence," but just conventionally. That is what the Gelugpas say that Bhagavad Gita said. And when I started reading this stuff, I was extremely skeptical for a long time about whether Jay Rinpoche could really convince me, because Bhagavad Gita really, when you read it, you're just like you're reading other Madhyamaka texts. It's a systematic attack on any conception of true or ultimate existence. And he'll even say that, that he refutes intrinsic nature. But here's the thing. Tsongkhapa, says that when he talks about refuting intrinsic nature, he'll put in an adverb, like from the ultimate perspective or from an ultimate point of view or ultimately. And he doesn't say, oh, and by the way, we still believe in this intrinsic nature conventionally, but then why did he put that adverb there? And so then it raises suspicions that he actually believes that things have some intrinsic nature at the conventional level. So there's a few little things like that where he doesn't assert intrinsic nature, but he refutes it ultimately. And he refutes all ultimate existence, and he refutes true existence. But he never says things have absolutely no intrinsic nature at all in any kind of conventional way or any other way. And because he doesn't say that, then, you read all the stuff. And of course, it takes a lot of work to figure this out. And because he doesn't come out and say it. And other people, so Tsongkhapa figured this out. Nobody, actually, so many people have been reading this book for hundreds of years. And they never said, oh, Baba Viveka has a fundamentally different view about what emptiness is than Chandrakirti. They said, oh, he's another Madhyamaka, but he has a really complicated, different theory about how to argue logically. So, there's a lot more to Tsongkhapa's argument. What he looks at this big logical difference between Buddhapalita and Chandrakirti and Bhava Viveka. And he's saying, why is Bhava Viveka so insistent upon this idea that you have to state a syllogism like that the sprout does not truly exist because of being independent arising to the person who believes in truly existent sprouts? Why is that so important to him? He seems to be, just hammering Buddhapalita on not saying that, even though Buddhapalita has all these other good ways of arguing against true and ultimate existence. What's the hang up there? And Tsongkhapa says that, the reason is that tacitly, without sort of, implicitly, Bhava Viveka, has adopted from Dignaga and Dharmakirti, these, logicians, who are themselves proponents of true existence. He's imported, along with their logic system, an epistemology which requires that in order for a mind to know something, it has to get at that thing's essential nature. And so, he's got this difference with Chandrakirti because, he thinks that, Bhava Viveka thinks, well, when I'm arguing with somebody who believes in true existence and they're looking at the sprout and I'm looking at the sprout, we're looking at the same, that we see the same thing because, things exist at the conventional level by way of their nature, and the other person believes that things exist at the conventional level by way of their nature, and so having agreed that things exist in the sprout exists at the conventional level by way of its nature, now all we have to do is argue about whether it has true existence or not. So we have between the, according to Tsongkhapa, we have between Bhava Viveka and the proponent of true existence what's called a commonly appearing subject. They are agreeing on what they're arguing about because they both agree that a sprout or a car or whatever potato, whatever you take as the thing to argue about, has some nature that the valid mind that's looking at the subject of the debate can get at and say, yeah, that's the subject of the debate. And they agree about that. And Chandrakirti is like attacking Baba Viveka for insisting on that, because he more explicitly and like Buddha Palita deeply implicitly don't agree that there can be a commonly appearing subject in that way. In other words, when a proponent of no true existence debates with a proponent of true existence, do they agree about the top, that there's some valid mind that looks at the topic of the debate and says, there it is, that's the cow that we're going to argue about, that's the sprout that we're going to argue about, and that's what it is. Well, in Chandrakirti's way, as interpreted by Tsongkhapa, there's no commonly appearing subject. Why? Because in Tsongkhapa's understanding of Chandrakirti, the very sense consciousnesses that look at the cow or the sprout are already deceived because they have a false appearance of that thing as inherently existing. So if we do the prasangika way, it's like the prasangika says, thing seems to appear as inherently existing, but we know that it's not. But nonetheless, we have an idea that, you know, we can know that it's a cow, even though it's falsely appearing as inherent existence. But the other person thinks, well, to be inherently existent or truly existent, inherently existent cow or sprout, that's what it means to be a sprout. And so that's what it means to have valid knowledge of that. So their idea of what valid knowledge is, the establishing subject, and the Madhyamaka's idea about what valid knowledge of establish the subject should be completely different. In fact, there shouldn't be a commonly appearing subject for the debate. And that was what Bhavadik was saying, well, we have to have something that we both agree on that we're talking about. And so why don't we just, you know, clearly state this syllogism and put the sprout at the beginning? Well, why is he so sure that that will be commonly appearing between him and the proponent of true existence? Tsongkhapa wonders. Why is he so sure that the proponent of true existence is going to agree with him about, you know, say, I have a valid cognition that knows, you know, this sprout, and, you know, you have a valid cognition that knows this sprout. Now let's argue about how it exists. You can't, from Tsongkhapa's point of view, as interpreting Chandrakirti, because our whole idea is that these things, in Chandrakirti Prasangika way, is that these things falsely appear as inherently existent, and nonetheless we're able to have valid knowledge of them somehow. Whereas in the proponent of true existence way, these things are appearing in the correct way, right? They're appearing as truly existent, and that's how we know that they're existent. If true existence, you know, so this false appearance that they have is not, that from the Prasangika point of view, is not considered false. It's just a taken for granted that, of course, things exist as they appear. So if a truly existent, if a sprout automatically means, you know, that to the proponent of true existence, a truly existent sprout, right? And then what is it going to do to say to that person, a sprout does not truly exist? Because it's dependent arising. Well, when you say sprout, they're going to take it that means like inherently existent, truly existent sprout. So it's like you're saying a truly existent sprout does not truly exist because to them, for there to be a sprout, that's a truly existent sprout. Okay. So, you know, Tsongkhapa is saying, well, why didn't Baba Viveka understand this? He's like this great logician and this deep Madhyamaka philosopher. How could he not understand what Buddha Palita was up to, that these people assume the exact opposite of what we're trying to approve? What we're trying to prove is when they look at the subject and think, okay, there's a sprout, they're already perceiving it as something as the exact opposite of what we're trying to prove. So how are we going to, like, just, it's like saying, to them it'll sound like saying a car is not a car because it's a dependent arising. That's what it'll sound like to them. Because it's like you're taking, you know, something that to them it's just to exist, and to be a dependent arising means to truly exist. So in other words, he's saying that you have to, because there's no commonly appearing subject between the proponent of true existence and the Madhyamaka who's refuting true existence, you have to like start by attacking the person's certainty about true existence and existence being the same thing by using contradictory consequences to sort of gradually undermine their certainty about this. And then once you've gotten that loosened up, then at some point, and this is according to Tsongkhapa's interpretation of Chandrakirti, you can state syllogisms. Tsongkhapa's reading of Chandrakirti is that we do have a view, we can state positions, we do have arguments, we do have theses. If a person is ready to hear the argument, you know, that the sprout doesn't truly exist because it's a dependent arising, we'll state it to them, we'll state it to ourselves, we think it's right. It's not that we refuse to hold that, it's just that we don't understand why Baba Vivek is so insistent upon stating to that to someone who just a priori assumes that sprout equals truly existent sprout. That's not going to like help them. You just have to start by weakening that a little bit. And for example, you know, tell them that, the sprout must never change and last forever because it truly exists. You know, say something to them that doesn't make sense, but would seem to be, from our point of view, a logical entailment of what they believe, right? And then that kind of like try to get them more doubtful about true existence and existence being exactly the same thing. And then at some point, then you can actually tell them the syllogism that you're thinking of. Okay, so that was the way Tsongkhapa interpreted the situation. And so that in that way, he parsed the distinction between Svatantrika. This whole argument about how to argue among Madhyamakas, he said, this is very specifically an argument about the view of and not just procedure, and what it entails, according to Tsongkhapa, is that Baba Vivek believes in inherent existence conventionally. But of course, he's an all-out opponent of ultimate and true existence, as I mentioned in the beginning. So he's a Madhyamaka, he's against ultimate existence, he's true existence. Anything you look for under analysis, including, say, you know, the nature of water is wet, when you search for it analytically, you don't find it. Everything's unfindable under analysis. But conventionally, things have an intrinsic nature. Okay, and this is according to Tsongkhapa's reading of, you know, what Baba Vivek had to mean. If he didn't mean that, why was he so insistent that he had a commonly appearing subject that he could argue with? About with the proponent of true existence. Okay. Now, a different way to say all this, which I came up with when I did my... because that was like, how was I going to explain that in an introduction to Empty Books book? So I started with this. I said, let's not talk about the words Svatantrika and Prasangika to begin with, because it's so... the whole history and so complicated. To start with this. Can we believe our eyes? Can we believe our senses? Like, if, you know, as proponents of Madhyamaka, do we think that our sense consciousnesses, as objects appear to us in our sense consciousness, that's, you know, trustworthy information that we can, you know, use to build arguments and so forth? And, you know, it seems like if you're not watching this carefully, you might say, well, yeah, that's what Tsongkhapa has just finished. That's what we mean by conventional valid cognition, right? didn't Guy just say that like 2 days ago? But you might... the answer is not that. No, you can't really trust what appears to your senses because there's a continual false appearance of things as inherently existent or intrinsically existent that's arising at the sensory level. We're deceived in the very nature of how things appear, according to Prasangika, according to Chandrakirti, according to Tsongkhapa and his followers in interpreting Chandrakirti, right? Whereas, you see what I'm saying? Baba Vivek seems to say, well, not so much. People believe in have a false conception of things as ultimately true. But when, you know, the proponent of, you know, they're wrong about that, so let's argue with them. Here's the proponent of true existence, and they're looking at the table, and here am I who just thinks that's ridiculous that you think there's something findable under analysis, and I'm looking at the table. And it's clear that we both are seeing the same thing and agree about what we're seeing, it is a table as it appears. So now let's just argue about this table as it appears, whether that table as it appears to both of us in common, that table as it appears to both of us in common, is that a table that we can find under analysis or not? And I will prove to you the proponent, I, Bhava Vega, will prove to you the proponent of true existence, that this table as it appears to us both in common, that table is not findable. So now he's refuted the idea that there's some ultimately existing table. But in the process, he's agreed that the table as it appears to his senses, as like having, you know, some nature on its own side, is a commonly appearing subject that he can debate about with the other person who is believing in true existence. So that's the question. Do we think there's a false appearance at the sensory level of things as having some intrinsic nature of their own? Basically, you could say that Chandrakirti and Bhava Viveka and Tsongkhapa are agreeing that things appear to us as though they have some nature of their own. They're just disagreeing about whether we can trust that part of what appears. And that kind of turns out to be kind of important, but that's what exactly they're disagreeing about. Yeah. And it didn't occur to me, you know, that if you start with that idea, it's like instead of starting with the history of the argument about the sprout and Sankhya's and self-risen, and don't start with the words, but just start with this question. As things appear to our senses, before we make a conceptual mistake, they're appearing as though they seem to have their own nature. Is that appearance, even at the conventional level, for conventional valid cognition, the sense that there's a nature of the tree, that, you know, it has its own distinctive character, right? That's on its own side, without being imputed by me. Is that appearance, like, trustable? And Bhava Viveka said, yeah, that's how we know. Well, Bhava Viveka as made up and imagined by Tsongkhapa, or deduced to be by Tsongkhapa. Bhava Viveka, because he never says this, you know, Bhava would say, yeah, of course, right? That's exactly what we mean by saying that one thing is different from the other, is that not ultimately, but conventionally, they have a different character which our valid cognizers get at and say, oh, that has the character of the tree, that has the character of the kitchen. Do you see what I'm saying? And that's exactly what the logicians, you know, Dignaga and Dharmakirti said. That's what it means to validly know something, is have a mind that gets at that character, feature, or nature in it and says, yeah, that's that, and it's not that. Okay, so that's the first part of this. Did you have any questions so far? No? Are you just boggled beyond belief? Or? Well, I can tell you one other way to think about it. All right. So I don't know if this will help make it worse. But because this is so hard to think about, like, and I made up this example, which I told you before. Okay, so I'll tell you the sort of full version of the thing. So the idea is that there's been a traffic accident, right? That represents cyclic existence. So this traffic accident has had, of course, since it's cyclic existence, injury. So it's a serious case, goes to court, right? So the Madhyamaka has a prosecution team, which consists of you and this guy that you haven't met before named Bhava Viveka, and he's actually lead counsel. So the defense calls this witness. That's like giving the testimony of the senses. You know, that's the witness that's called to the stand. And the defense calls the witness, and the witness has, you know, observed the afflictions in action and so forth, observed how cyclic existence unfolds, and the witness gives testimony about what she or he saw at the accident, right, and what the light was doing and so forth. And then Bhava Viveka, and you're just sitting there taking notes, Bhava Viveka, senior counsel, gets up to do the cross-examination and is trying to, you know, impugn the witness and get it to be clear that there, you know, really was a damage done by ignorance here. And the problem is that, hey, you're listening to this, And it becomes clear that Baba Viveka doesn't know, doesn't understand that the witness is completely colorblind. And the witness cannot tell the difference between red and green. And so Baba Viveka just assumes that when we listen to the testimony of the senses, that's the testimony of the witness, right? We listen to the testimony of the senses, we can take what we're getting at face value and use that as a basis for arguments to try to undermine this ultimate existence, or, you know, the defense case. Well, we can take the evidence of the senses at face value, and he hasn't recognized that the senses giving testimony up here on the stand have completely conflated red and green, which stands for, of course, existence and here in existence, and doesn't know the difference between these two. So you're sitting there listening to it, and you're thinking, there's a problem in our whole prosecution argument here, because if we don't notice that the senses are giving confusing evidence because they don't know the difference between red and green, the biggest, the strongest part of our case is gone, right? We can't. The person is sincere, the witness is sincere, our senses are sincere, right? And they do have accurate information to give. They're not intending to lie. And Baba Viveka also, you know, has that same assumption that this is all reliable evidence. So if the prosecution has the assumption that it's all reliable evidence and the senses are giving this reliable evidence, then how are we going to undermine this witness who seems to be exculpating, you know, the and so that's the idea. It's like, think of the senses as like what's giving testimony, right? And that Baba Viveka is, you know, he's trying to prove that ignorance is guilty because it is, you know, committed an imputation of a true existence here and causing serious damage throughout the universe, right? But in trying to make this argument, he doesn't understand that his witness has this. You know, so you can't just say to the person, well, was the light red or green? Mm-hmm. You have to get them, you have to approach the cross-examination in a much subtler way to draw out something that they have evidence of but haven't thought of. You see what I'm saying? And you have to go dig deeper, right, beyond what they think that they know. And that's why the Prasanga, it's not because the Prasangika doesn't have any position. It's because they know that all of the evidence that they have to rely upon is sort of at one level tainted, because it all comes from colorblind witnesses, where color here represents ontologically blind. You know, like all the evidence of our senses that we use to make arguments against inherent existence or ultimate existence all comes ultimately from sense experience, which is all contaminated with appearance of inherent existence. And Tsongkhapa says, well, Chandrakirti knows that. Implicitly, he infers that Buddhapalita and Nagarjuna know that. But it seems Baba Viveka hasn't. Okay. Well, I don't know how. I can't pick up the train of my discourse from that. But I could try to, like, repeat the general point. Yeah. Yeah. If I talk slower. I get excited. Okay. It occurred to me while I was talking that there's agreement that to our senses things appear conventionally to have their own nature. They're agreeing about that. What they're disagreeing about is whether conventionally things do have their own nature. That's, I think, what I was saying. Yeah. It hadn't really even occurred to me until I started talking about that. Like, oh, that's really true. They're all agreeing. It's not that some people think that things are. They're all agreeing that. It's not that some people think that inherent nature is appearing to your senses, and some people think it isn't. It's that they're all agreeing that things appear like they have their own distinctive nature, even at the sensory level. It's just that some people think that appearance is reliable and just a given, and that's how we know what's what. And other people think that's nigh on to the root of cyclic existence. That is, that assenting to that kind of appearance is the root of cyclic existence. Well, okay, Well, okay, I'll try to say it. We're talking within Madhyamaka, so they all agree that when you analyze deeply and you look into the question, what is some things really, you find unfindability of any ultimate nature in the thing. Okay, they're all agreeing about that. But the idea is that when we have just at the sensory level, not thinking in terms of what we're thinking about things are appearing to have their own nature or to have their own distinctive character on their own side, apart from what the mind is slapping on top. They all agree that things appear that way. Right? And then the question is, do you trust that appearance of things having their distinct character conventionally and think that's good because that's how we can tell right from wrong, up from down, hot from cold? It's because each thing has its distinctive, unique character at the conventional level. Even though they're all empty ultimately, but at the conventional level, each thing has its own unique, distinctive character, and when we get at that character with the mind, we see what it is, then that's how we know this is this and that. Very important. That's Bhava Viveka as constructed by Tsongkhapa. By the way, I've come to think that he's right, but it took me a long time. I didn't think he was right. I had serious qualms about this for a long time. It's not that easy to... First, the whole thing is complicated. And then when you read the evidence, it's like some kind of, you know, philosophical detective story. And the whole time you're trying to figure out, well, if this is so true and obvious, why would it take like hundreds of years for anybody to figure it out? Yeah. So anyway, there can be different opinions about how convincing Tsongkhapa's case is. But anyway, Tsongkhapa's construction of Bhava Viveka is, you know, that he just takes the kind of idea about valid cognition that comes from Sautrantika, essentially, and says, you know, like, things each have their own distinctive character. It appears to our senses, and we, like, know these things as what they are. Because our mind is sort of getting at the distinctive character conventionally, and you know, like maybe in a minute I'll become Bhava Viveka. So I don't want you to think that, you know, that this means in any way that I'm in any way, shape, or form agreeing that things don't have true. Of course, when you search to see what this nature is ultimately and how it exists, you know, in and of itself, chopping it up into parts and searching for its dependent relations, of course you don't find anything. That's what we mean by being followers of Nagarjuna. But meanwhile, we have to like make some distinctions, and we can make those distinctions by the conventional level, recognizing that things have their own distinctive character, and that's how we know what's what. Seems pretty self-evidently right system to me. I'm going to advocate it here, and we'll see. Yeah.
Bhava Viveka's distinctive character and Tsongkhapa's valid cognition seem awfully close.
Tsongkhapa's trying to have valid cognition in the absence of any essentially existent character, and he's basing that on Chandrakirti. So what he has to do is say Bhava Viveka was wrong in trusting the appearance of the senses when they were telling us that things inherently existed. But nonetheless, we can have valid cognition. It's such that we have to recognize that our valid cognitions are all mistaken. What are they mistaken about? They're not mistaken about whether red is blue or red is green or the kitchen is a tree. They're mistaken about whether those things inherently exist. So that is the whole idea in Tsongkhapa Chandrakirti Prasangika system. You know, leaving aside, you know, all sort of higher types of minds, all of our ordinary, you know, kinds of valid cognitions are associated with a false aspect, and it doesn't. They call that mistakenness to distinguish it from right and being correct or incorrect. Say they're mistaken and unmistaken. They just have to use some. They use different words in Tibetan, so we just use different words. I mean, the words could, you know, just ordinary parlance mean the same thing, but they're just saying, look, there's a level at which, and a sense in which they're off, and then at the same time, that doesn't mean they're other. That's why I came up with the colorblind witness, because this is a person who's honest, was there, saw what happened, is trying to be, you know, in good faith with, that's our senses. They don't have any axe to grind in and of themselves on their own side about whether things inherently exist. They're just going to tell you what they saw. Okay? And, you know, if they saw a fire that appeared to exist from its own side as hot, then that's what they give you. Now, what are you going to do with that? And it's like, oh yeah, well, now we know that it's fire because it has that character of hotness in it, would be one way. Right, and that would, and then we could say, even though it has that character as of hotness, and that's how we correctly know that it's fire, it doesn't ultimately exist as fire. And then you're Bhava Viveka, because you like recognize the essential character of that fire as hot. You've been able to tell the difference between the cow and the cup because each had this distinctive character, right? And weren't confused about which one to drink out of, even though knowing that they're all ultimately empty.
So, what are they saying is there that Tsongkhapa
is saying isn't there? Okay. Well, first of all, they don't say, really. I mean, what you, as I said, Bhava Viveka doesn't say that he believes in this. Tsongkhapa says that Bhava Viveka implies that he believes in it. And I have come to the view that he has a good foundation, and he's probably right. You know, it's like in the area of, like, a person didn't make this distinction, and by not making it, they probably bought into something that they may or may not have intended to buy into. And then they got called on it, but they were already dead by then. Right. It was difficult for them to say, oh, Chandrakirti is right. You know, that's really not what I meant to say. I didn't really think that, you know, these valid knowledge of things was getting at some essential character. But the good reason to think, I mean, the force of his argument is like, why, of Tsongkhapa's argument is like, you know, Bhava Viveka is the logician, you know, just like they call Dolpa the omniscient. Everybody has their little epithet. Bhava Viveka is called the logician. Well, he's a logician. He's like, you don't, there aren't a lot of Madhyamaka scholars who are called the logician. You know, the only other one who comes to mind is Chaba, you know, in Tibet, but he's identified with logic. But it's like, so he's the logician. And if he's such a great logician, then, like, why would he understand this reductio ad absurdum procedure? Well, the reason was because he was, there was, maybe this is overstating a little bit, but there was like a fad, or that is a milieu, an atmosphere within, there was the hot thing intellectually, right? And he was onto it, was to use Dignaga Dharmakirti logic. And he was going to be the one who took the new, because it wasn't around in Nagarjuna, he's going to take the new Dignaga Dharmakirti logic and use it to re-explain what... See, when Nagarjuna was writing, he didn't have the Dignaga Dharmakirti logic. He just, you know, made these arguments, and a lot of them are reductio ad absurdum. And Bhava Viveka was like, okay, well, we can take those reductio ad absurdum. You know what that means? When you say, this sprout must continually be reproduced over and over again forever because you say that it's produced from itself. That's like, so you have this crazy idea, but instead of telling you the idea is wrong, I'm going to tell you what even crazier thing that you will have to acknowledge is crazy is a direct consequence of it. That's called reductio ad absurdum in Latin, right? And it's called prasanga in Sanskrit, right? And tengir in Tibetan, right? It's basically the same idea. You're not telling the person, this is my view. You're telling them, you use their view as a reason. And then you make up some thesis. And it really is not the point whether you agree with the thesis or not. Usually, no one agrees with it. You pick something that's like utterly absurd. But the point of it is that the other person will absolutely not accept the thesis, right? And it was clear that they won't. But that you'll be able to lead them into feeling that, gosh, that thing which I absolutely don't want to accept is going to follow from what I've claimed, right? That's the kind of arguments Buddha follows. Almost all of his arguments are sort of set up like that, most of them. many of the predominance of Nagarjuna's arguments are set up like that. And then, you know, Dignaga and Dharmakirti worked out this logical system for Buddhism, and it posited the idea that you should be able to make an argument, and the argument should work in this way, where the two parties to the argument have both agreed on all the elements of the argument. I just use the subject as the example, but you know, you're supposed to agree to all the elements, so that, you know, we know when we say mountain and the reason clause, that we're both talking about the same thing and so forth. So you have to have some sort of common agreement about the elements in order to have the... Otherwise, the force of the inference doesn't work because people are talking about two different things. So that was like, taking those ideas about we have to make a syllogism that has these commonly certified, commonly agreed to elements, and then prove what our view is. And Bhava Viveka was saying, this is what Buddhist logic is now about. And it's already happened since Buddhapalita wrote. And yet Buddhapalita has foolishly failed to, you know, catch on to the new thing. And he's still using these kind of reductio ad absurdum arguments of just telling people like crazy consequences of the things that they think. And why doesn't he tell them that things don't ultimately exist because they're dependent arisings, and like prove to them, you know, what it is that we're trying to prove? And Chandrakirti then, you know, says, well, why should he have to do that? And, you know, then it gets really complicated. Exactly how much of the argument that Tsongkhapa makes later comes across in Chandrakirti's critique of Bhava Viveka. But anyway, what Tsongkhapa finds in Chandrakirti's critique of Bhava Viveka is underlying, you know, Chandrakirti sticking up for Buddhapalita was this idea that, we can have a view or a position, but there's no reason to insist upon stating it to somebody to whom it won't make any sense, because they'll have this completely different idea about what the subject is. And Bhava Viveka should have known that if he understood that these people had a completely different image of what the subject was. And since he'd insisted anyway, he must not have known that these people had a different image of what the subject is. And that must mean that he believes in inherent existence.
But then the question comes up, why didn't Chandrakirti see that in Bhava Viveka and pointed out?
Well, I think that Tsongkhapa thinks that Chandrakirti did see it in Bhava Viveka, but he doesn't come right out and say, "Oh, you Bhava Viveka, I have caught you believing in inherent existence," which would have been convenient, because But anyway,
if Bhava Viveka was so unhappy with Buddhapalita's
reductio ad absurdum,
then what do you think about Nagarjuna? Most of Nagarjuna's work used the same method.
Well, see, there's a big difference. He thinks Nagarjuna is amazing and he's going to elucidate the intention of, you know, his intention and so forth. But when Nagarjuna is writing the Karikas, this system of Buddhist logic doesn't exist. And so he thinks that these syllogisms, that Nagarjuna's arguments are very profound and important. And to be frank, what he thinks is they really need to be reformulated in the modern logical style, which, you know, and that it's really a contribution, right, to Buddhist philosophy to move to the view. You know, he's like taking he's not changing the view, but he's putting it in the proper logical format as that is understood hundreds of years after, you know, Nagarjuna is gone by, you know, conventional reckoning. If you go by like a very traditional Tibetan reckoning, I guess Nagarjuna was writing tantric texts or something by then. But I don't know. I'm not sure. But he would, you know. But anyway, by regular way of thinking, Nagarjuna was gone onto the Pure Land. So he wasn't there to change his own books, right? And they were looking at, he wasn't. My view is that Nagarjuna was not alive when Dignaga and Dharmakirti came up with their logical systems. And so he was not, you know, situated to incorporate their idea about what was appropriate. And certainly the Karikas, even if he was alive, the Karikas were written way before these. But Buddhapalita, on the other hand, was after Dignaga and Dharmakirti. And he could have known that this was the way to do it, Bhagavad Gita thinks that he ought to have known and that he ought to have done it that way. And so he's kind of, I don't know, you know, you get this attitude, it's like kind of, he's a little condescending to Buddha Palita, frankly, you know. It's like you're kind of a little bit crude and old-fashioned in the way you're pushing the arguments forward. There's a different kind of style, totally. Buddha Palita is very much on the side, like Chandrakirti, of pointing to the conventional and saying, you know, well, this is how people say, and this is the way it is in the world. And then he gives these, like, examples of, you know, I don't know, I can't... Oh, well, the example I told about the two villagers arguing about which god was which. And right, that's Buddha Palita. He has, like, lots of stories, and then even when he's not telling stories, he's, like, got examples that touch back to common experience, right? And which, of course, in a sense, everybody has to do, but, you know, you get the feel for Buddha Palita. He's looking at the conventional as his reference point to make judgments. Whereas for Bhava Viveka, it's like the emphasis is on a proper logical form which will prove something by conventional valid analysis. And that conventional valid analysis will, according to, you know, it's like, well, how do you, then that's where you get the whole thing. If you think you can really prove this, then do you, according to your lights of what a proper proof should be, you know, you should have a common subject with the person you're arguing with. And why do you think you have that? It's because you're taking the object as appearing in the same way that the other person is. So you must believe that things exist as they appear. You must believe, you, Bhava Viveka, says Tsongkhapa, must believe, you know, that things exist in accordance with their appearance as inherent existent, conventionally. Although, of course, we acknowledge that you totally refute the ultimate and true existence.
So what's the import of, I mean, if we're to take Tsongkhapa as being correct, what does that mean for Bhava Viveka? I mean, because obviously it's kind of hard to even conceive of something existing truly conventionally and not ultimately. That's just hard to conceive of.
Now it's hard for you because you guys are like totally marinated in it's so funny. It's like no. It's not hard. It's really easy. It's, yeah. You're thinking, oh, how can something not be ultimate? If you're saying it's not ultimate existence, then how can it be inherently existent? That's what you're saying, right? Oh, of course it can be. Well, I'm being Bhava Viveka now. Okay? Is it okay? Is it okay? Like, okay. Look, all I'm saying is that the coming into existence of knowledge is a collaborative process. It's a dependent arising, as Venerable Chögrön also taught many centuries after I lived. And this collaboration is a collaboration between the object and the consciousness. And the consciousness, it's not just like a one-way street where the consciousness confabulates any old thing it wants to, as that fellow Chandrakirti says, everything being mere imputations by thought. No, of course not. You know, things have a certain character, but they don't have their own, you know, it's not like this character just is like, you know, ultimately findable, but they have a distinct nature and that exists conventionally as long as we don't, you know, of course, if we look for it and try to say, if somebody says, oh, show me the character of the cup, of course, I ultimately will not be able to point it out. Of course, you know, but conventionally we can say that there's a certain character to the cup and a certain character to the cow. And it's not just me making up the difference between the two in a sort of conceptual construction. They have some sort of different character on their own side. And it's through the interaction of my mind having a certain framework and way of looking at the world, right? And it, from my point of view, in interaction with how the kind of character of the object, that's what constitutes, you know, what the object is. It's a two-way street. You know, you've got to have something. Everybody keeps saying there's got to be something on the object side. It can't be nothing whatsoever. Well, now you have your man. There's just a little bit that's over there. You know, a little convention. It's got, each thing has a distinctive conventional character that is absolutely unfindable under analysis, but exists conventionally as the, what allows us to validly know that's a tree and that's a mountain.
So
That's what it means to say, and that's when you say things exist inherently or intrinsically. It just means like, oh, well, all I'm saying, I'm Bhava Viveka. All I'm saying is each thing has its own respective, distinctive nature. And, it, you know, that nature is what we mean by saying, I know that that's a tree. Of course, we're not going to find it when we look ultimately, but it has something on its own side. You don't think that you don't really believe that all this is just a, if you're going to go with the way of saying all this is just a mental construction, how are you going to differentiate yourself from all those, you know, nihilists, hyper-realists who say, you know, everything is just all this is constructed by delusion. But conceptual thought is not in the mind of Buddha. You're saying everything that exists is merely a construction by conceptual thought. You people, followers of Chandrakirti, have some serious problems to address. Just like taking it for granted that your whole system is workable, but like nobody in, you know, when Chandrakirti wrote this in India, it wasn't like everybody lined up and said, oh, that's the great breakthrough. We didn't even bother translating into Tibetan for hundreds of years, and we always translated all these other books. Because this is a guy who's essentially kind of a nihilist who is insisting that there wasn't anything there in the conventional at all. And it didn't seem to us, most of, you know, in most of us Buddhists in India, that that was going to be a workable basis for the practice of the path. So we kind of went with the Satantrika or the Chittamatra or one of the, you know, Satranika. All these were like, you know, good systems. Because they told us that we suffer unnecessarily in cyclic existence due to an exaggerated reification. But they didn't claim that there was, like, at the base, reification means something's been reified. Something's been exaggerated over how it really exists. So back there behind it all, there is something. It's just that we've totally misunderstood how it is. And so what is that something that's been exaggerated or reified? There has to be something. And Chandrakirti, we think, says that there's nothing because everything is prajnapti matra, you know, it's just dokpe daksam, it's just an imputation by conceptual thought. What are you computing onto? You know, I say, Bhava Viveka, yeah, there is imputation by conceptual thought. There is like an overlay of true existence that's being put onto things, and that is true. That's why we suffer unnecessarily, and that's why Nagarjuna was so great, because he refuted this. But it's imputed onto something. It's like the tree's basic character as a tree is what, you know, allows me to know validly that that's a tree.
They would say that its basic character as a tree. So
it has each thing. Things have their own distinctive character. Their own, yeah. Their own, yeah. Their own. I would. The way Tsongkhapa puts it, you know, of course he's trying to get ready to refute it, is he says that each thing has its own uncommon mode of subsistence without being imputed by conventional thought, without being imputed by thought. So that, you know, that there's something up. Each thing has its own uncommon mode of subsistence without being imputed by thought. So that means that there's something on the object side. Now it doesn't mean there is imputation by thought, but there's something on the object side that's the base that and so the imputation. It's not like trees are just able to just like autonomously, independently, truly establish themselves as trees. Of course not. But they're legitimately. If you Tsongkhapa Chandrakirti people agree that the establishment of that as a tree is done in relationship to a basis of designation. And when you say that there's a basis of designation, that's the basis of imputation of tree, that's what I'm talking about when I say that there's some nature or character that's there on the object side that like makes it for, you know, that's there. It has its own distinct, uncommon mode of subsistence. The tree has its sort of a way of existing on the tree side that makes it suitable for me to look at that. Now, it doesn't just look at it and go, tree. That's what I say. It's not that it's just like, you know, there's a collaboration between the mind and the object. Things don't ultimately, it's not ultimately existing as a tree. If we go and look and say, oh, guy's claiming there's an intrinsic nature of treeness in the tree, let's go and look for it. You know, like Venerable Chogyam saying, well, guy says there's intrinsic nature in the cup. Find it. Show it to me. Of course I can't find it and pin it down and show it to you. When you break it down into ultimate analysis, you'll never be able to find it. But my view is that, as I'm Bhagavad Gita still, right? My view is that it's very clear that there has to be some difference of character on the object side. Who seriously propounds a system in which there's no difference between cows and cups on the side of the object and thinks that all the difference between those is merely made up by the mind?
Nature, then it must have its own ultimate nature too.
Why?
Because where does that conventional nature come from? You're saying it's just fairy dust.
No.
Is it some nature on its own? When I ask you what this nature is, you can't say. Oh,
well, I can't find it. No, it's like
it's there, but
no. That's what I said. I said, you know. I said, you know, because you're valid conventional, you're sitting there pretending that you don't know what the character of a cup is when you know perfectly well that this has the character of the cup conventionally, and this has the character of the glass conventionally, this has the character of the glasses conventionally. And I'm not saying that they're ultimately findable, but each thing has its distinctive, unique character.
Then why do you even need to label it if it has its own distinct character? Labeling is superfluous.
Well, they have to. I would say I still accept that, you know, when the gods, ghosts, and the humans come to the river, they can. The mind is imputing things, but it's not imputing things groundlessly. It's imputing things in relationship to a character that's in the object.
So it's there inherently in the object, ultimately.
Wait a minute. It's there inherently. It's there in the object. Why'd you get ultimately near? I just told you. I'm totally against anything ultimate and findable. These are conventionally existent natures.
But then you don't need to label them. If
Why not?
If it has some inherent existence conventionally, you don't need to label it. There's some nature there that's already there. Why do you need to go to the trouble of labeling it?
Well,
you're saying everything has its own nature. That's how you discriminate one thing from another. It has its own nature on its own side. So you don't need to label anything.
Well, things...
You're not even imagining.
Yeah. Well, no, I disagree. That's why I threw in the thing about the gods, ghosts, and humans coming to the river, because I'm going to say that, you know, the distinctive character that things have on their own side doesn't preclude beings who have different conceptual frameworks coming to the situation and constructing them as different objects. It's not that they're absolutely, fully, and entirely like established for, you know, in an ultimate or true way on their own side. That's my point. That's why I am a Madhyamika. There's no ultimately findable, you know, cup in the cup. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that conventionally it has its own distinctive nature that makes it suitable for a person like me to impute it as a cup. And that's what you're choosing to call basis of imputation, and what I'm choosing to call its conventionally existent intrinsic character. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, why is that different?
Then the human being should be able to see flesh and blood. Why not? It has its own character.
No, that's what I'm saying, is that we are doing some, we have, on the basis of our own distinctive karma, we have some superimposition that we do in relationship to the intrinsic.
You have something there, plus you're doing some imposition.
I can't. That's exactly what I am saying. In fact, I'm saying that you said it. I'm saying that you said it. No, I'm saying that you said it. I'm not only saying it, I'm saying that you said it. I heard you say it when you were explaining how objects come to be through a collaborative process. I'm telling you that's exactly right. And that, you know, it's one thing to say objects are established through a collaborative process between the mind and the object, and another thing to turn around and say they're all merely imputed by thought. How they all get merely imputed? What's that merely mean? Merely imputed by thought, and then you've got the table. Yeah, it's like, well, what is it imputing it on? I heard that question. Well, what is it imputing it on? You said the table. And it's like, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Forget your labels.
The
question
before you saying
the historical.
The reason it's coming up with the same
yeah.
table there,
Now let me tell you how it doesn't get called into the exists. That the only reason why we label it is so we can get rid of the label ultimately.
He does say that. Well, it's not the only reason. It's not the only reason. There's another reason. And that's the same thing that Tsongkhapa believes in. That is, you have to be able to do analysis at the conventional level in order to have the practice of the path. And that's all these people in Tibet. I'm now a clairvoyant Baba Vibeka. Looking into the future. All those people in Tibet, you know, when they looked at Chandrakirti and they tried to rely on Chandrakirti, they had all these problems with nihilism precisely because they thought that, you know, everything was just made up by thought and they weren't able to posit valid conventional distinctions within the context of this system where everything's a mere imputation by thought. And now, of course, Tsongkhapa came along later and pretended to be able to do that, says I, Baba Vibeka. But really, he has covertly imported some kind of crypto-spatantrika thing and called it the system of Chandrakirti. And I, as Baba Vibeka, don't mind at all. I think that's just fine. They're all practicing all those Gilupas that are really practicing Svatantrika, and they just choose to call it Chandrakirti's system. Then I don't really need the credit as long as it's my philosophy that's going forward. Yes.
I'm with you, Bob. No. It's something inherently exists conventionally. It doesn't necessarily inherently exist conventionally as the referent object of a certain term. So just because it exists inherently doesn't mean it inherently exists as a tree. It just has something there.
That's what I was trying to say. That is what I was trying to say. It has some distinctive character which, for me, is suitable to designate as a tree, but might be for the hungry ghost suitable to designate as a, you know, some terrible thing, right? But it still has to be something on the object side. That's. Okay. But anyway, that's.
So what would if you look ahead to Tsongkhapa and with your omniscient eye, what? When Tsongkhapa makes all these arguments about you and your philosophy, what is he really, what's the import of that? I mean, what does it really matter as long as you're negating inherent existence, ultimately inherently existence? So obviously he sees something wrong with what you're saying. I don't know where or how, but what does it matter, really? I mean, From Tsongkhapa's point of view, what if in the end you're saying ultimately nothing exists, are you really still an absolutist because you say conventionally they truly exist? Or?
Well, what I would say as Baba Vibeka about Tsongkhapa is that he understood correctly that it was really necessary to establish the importance of conventional valid cognition, and he studied Dignaga and Dharmakirti carefully, and he, being well informed, unlike that rube Buddhapalaka, he was well informed about how to do Buddhist logic and how to do Buddhist epistemology, but so he recognized that there has to be a way to establish things, just as I did, you know, as a staff say, this is what I assert, and here is why I prove it by some conventionally valid reason. And that was exactly what I, Baba Vibeka, was trying to do. And all these crazy people were saying, oh no, we don't have any intrinsically existent position. And look at Nagarjuna's refutation of objections where he says, you know, I will have no position, and they would cite these kinds of texts and say, well, we can't really take any position, we'll just refute the other person's position. But that was wrong. And Tsongkhapa, and I knew it was wrong, and I said what the position was, and I tried to prove the position using proper logic, and Tsongkhapa completely understood that and did the same thing, and he did it in the face of a whole bunch of Tibetans who were going along with this crazy idea that there wasn't any thesis to be proven. And he proved that, yeah, that's a self-contradictory position. You're now taking the position that there's no position. It totally falls apart. And what you have to say is that, you know, although we don't believe in anything ultimately, conventionally, we believe that nothing exists in a true or ultimate way. And Tsongkhapa totally had all that figured out. But for some reason, he chose to call this approach, you know, the system of you know, he put in words like lack of inherent existence, and to follow the say that he was following the system of Chandrakirti. And you know, then he was totally criticized by other Tibetans who came later, you know, for saying that he was really a follower of Chandrakirti when he was using conventional valid logic from Dignagan and Dharmakirti to establish things validly. And of course, that he should have been criticized for that. And that's because he wasn't really a follower of Chandrakirti. He was a, just, you know, he thought that he was, but what he really was my follower. Yeah, I was going to say something else, but it went out of my mind. So, yeah. That's what I would say, is that he had basically the right idea, which was that he agreed with me, but he just didn't. He thought that it was really important. You know, at some level, his mind he had what Marxists call, you know, false consciousness. He thought that he disagreed with me, and so made a big show of refuting me, when in fact his end up position is just like mine. He's an anonymous psychopath. And the thing is that I figure that it was just like in his day. It was so cool to be a prasangika. You couldn't like come out and say, "Oh, I'm going one rung down on the tenets ladder." You had to be a prasangika, and so then you know, I Bhava Viveka, right? I'm not actually channeling my own point of view in all of this, but I Bhava Viveka just think that, you know, he was buying into the idea that the best view was Chandrakirti's, and that he was going to show how to establish things in the way they should be established, but try to say that he was doing it within Chandrakirti's view. But it's not really consistent with what... It's not compatible with what Chandrakirti taught. And Chandrakirti didn't... I, Bhava Viveka, said, looking forward in the future, Chandrakirti doesn't really, like, say that this is, you know, valid cognition works in the following way, and I will now explain to you, you know, how valid cognition validly establishes objects. He makes a few vague references to it here and there, but compare that to me, where, you know, I've got a whole thing is set up based on showing you how to establish arguments and how they work to prove things.
So then how do you guys
refute? No, I'm not going to. It's too much for today. It's like today I have worked upon becoming, you know, possessed by... First, I had to be possessed by Tsongkhapa to show you what Bhava Viveka did wrong. And then I had to become Bhava Viveka. So it was too much strain for me to then change persona yet again. But I had Venerable Trigon here to help me and to remind you that I was not saying the correct position.
There has to be a valid basis of imputation.
Yes.
Did Jane Rinpoche say that, or was that later
Galupas? Yeah, I don't know. What does it mean for something to conventionally exist? So what he says in the Great Treatise is just what I already taught, right? That for something to conventionally exist, there has to be a conventional imputation of it, and then non-contradiction by these two types of valid cognition. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't mention anything in that section when I remember anything about this basis of imputation. But I would not be sure that he didn't say it. I would sort of suspect that he does talk about this, but it just doesn't appear to my mind.
Because they make such a big deal about that now. But
oh, yeah.
I've heard sometimes people say, "Oh, that's actually going to the absolutist side by saying there has to be a valid
basis of imputation." Well, like in John, I know that the first place that I can remember reading that specifically, and I not to say that it isn't in Jerome Petit, but I remember reading about it in John Yucheva's great exposition of Tenets, and maybe, I don't know, Night of Venice's great exposition of the Middle Way, and in which he says, he talks about this idea of, it's almost like a modern correspondence theory. He uses the word tumba in Tibetan, which means, you know, accordance. He's talking about there has to be an accordance or a correspondence or a harmony between the object imputed and the basis of imputation. And when I, you know, you're reading that and you're thinking, yes, that, you know, where did, that's not in Chandrakirti. You know, that's not the way Chandrakirti talks. It's not the way Buddha Pallita talk. So is that the way that, when I, in my books where I talk about all the different things that Gilbert say about what it means for conventional things to exist conventionally, I do include that. But I've never really worked out in my mind thoroughly philosophically, like, how that relates to the other ways and or what its original sources are. Yeah. Sorry. There was another... there's this other idea that Bhava-Tantrika is associated with, and that is not to do with this, but the idea that... I'll say that, like, all four of the noble truths are conventional truths, and true cessations are conventional truths. And it seems that, like, most prasangikas, most people who say they're prasangikas are going around insisting that, you know, that the true cessations are ultimate truths. And this really doesn't, I'm so bothered, this doesn't really make very much sense. And fortunately, there was this guy, Panchen Sonam Trakpa, who was like the Losling textbook writer, and he basically agreed with me and just seems to have run roughshod over everything Jay Rinpoche said about this, and basically said, if you look at the, you know, look at the reasoning, you can, you know, find that, of course he didn't mention me, but you could find that that is true, that it just doesn't make any sense to say that nirvana is the same as emptiness. These are, like, not the same. Nirvana is the what we understand as this the permanent coming to an end of a portion of the afflictions, never to arise again. And that's you could say that that's a non-affirming negative, but it's not the same as the lack of ultimate existence. It's like that's obviously something completely different. The lack of ultimate existence has always existed everywhere and everything. Whereas nirvana hasn't, and then, you know, if you say it has, there's all sorts of obvious faults that why are we striving on the path and so forth. So it's clear that nirvana is not the basic mode of existence of all things. It's, you know, something we strive on the path to attain, and therefore, it, you know, that nirvana is a true cessation and it's something that we don't have and then we get. How can you say that's the same as emptiness, which is the mode of abiding of all phenomena? So it therefore follows that true cessations or nirvanas are conventional truths. They're very important conventional truths, but they're just, you know, other things that are empty of inherent existence. They aren't emptiness itself.
Why isn't nirvana a shukha?
Well, actually, they do talk about that, nirvana as a... Jigpa is this concept of a pastness or a disintegratedness, right? Something having ceased, right? Are you asking...
Why isn't a true cessation a having ceased?
Well, when I was around, we didn't have this idea of having ceasedness as a thing. That was something Chandrakirti made up later on. But I think it's probably one of his, now I'm just making up what I think Bhava Vivekan might say, I think it's probably one of his better ideas because I'm perfectly comfortable with the idea of nirvana as being a state of having ceasedness. That is to say, it's something that comes about at a certain point in time. It's not like a permanent thing. It's a changing, disintegrating thing, and it doesn't exist primordially. It's not the basic mode of abiding of things. It's the having ceased, and then subsequently the having ceasedness of some portion of the afflictions. So I just think it's out of the loop that, you know, the followers of Chandrakirti, for the most part, except for a few people who have, you know, have their heads screwed on right, are going around saying that, like, nirvana is emptiness. Why would they say that?
But then you would say also that Pinchon Trungpa didn't know what he was talking about either.
Oh, because he doesn't use the Shikpa idea.
Right. Yeah. He says it's a non-affirming negative.
Oh,
Shikpa,
I see.
It's an affirming negative.
Mm, true. Well, I haven't thought about that. Yeah. If you go by Chandrakirti's way, then that's true. You would have to say that it was an affirming negative. What I as Bhava Viveka would like to emphasize is that there's two different things between nirvana and emptiness. And if you really, you know, I would prefer to call the nirvana a conventional truth, but if you really feel that it's important to call it an ultimate truth, you're going to have to remember that now you have an ultimate truth that are not the final mode of abiding of all phenomena, like all the other ones, because nirvana is not the final, that's not how things exist. Things don't exist nirvanically, things exist emptily. And that's not the same thing. Who thinks that? Well, it turns out that a lot of people do. But I, Bhava Viveka, know better. I thought I would just say that because you asked me to. Didn't you ask me to say something about that? Yeah, okay. So, yeah, anyway, I could guess out tomorrow. I'll tell you what the Prasanga can say about that. I feel like as far as the other stuff, I really kind of, you know, with the whole Dokpe Daktam, the whole conceptual imputation by thought, that's kind of like what we were doing when I first came for a lot of the time, was trying to think about, well, what would it mean? What would it mean for things to just be, you know, made up by thought? And you can see that it was very difficult. And that's why I wanted to be Bhava Viveka, because it makes me, I don't think you can make it too easy. We just get habituated to say, of course, everything's, you know, we can read, the poem, that Jay Rinpoche wrote about, you know, praising Buddha as the teacher of dependent arising, and it's all about dependent arising and here in existence having the same meaning. And it just comes to us to feel self-evident. But it wasn't self-evident to Jay Rinpoche until after he was enlightened. You know, he was singing this song after he'd been working on trying to figure out something that seemed impossibly difficult for a long time. And I don't know. We could get into the, you know, how His Holiness is saying, oh, well, these galupas just say things the mind is luminous and knowing, but they don't really know what they're talking about. And we wouldn't want to be like that about, you know, what it means to say things are mere imputations by thought. Yeah.
But if you ever get a sense or trace this whole idea of the valid basis of designation, I'd be quite curious.
Yeah, that's a really,
why it began.
Yeah. Okay, that's a really good question. I can't say that I've read it in Tsongkhapa for sure. Okay, well, I think that's enough. That's like only an hour and a half, but it was a mental workout.